35 years ago, we were in the first weeks of the Iranian hostage crisis. This hour, we remember the Iranian Revolution with a former hostage. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest this hour is native Iowan Catherine Kobe. Kobe was one of the 52 hostages held in Tehran for over a year. She'll tell us about the day in 1979 when she was captured by Iranian revolutionaries and how she was treated in over a year of captivity. Also with us, Grinnell political science professor Wayne Moyer. He'll put the hostage crisis in context and give us his thoughts on how the Iranian Revolution changed the geopolitical landscape. Remembering the Iranian hostage crisis 35 years ago. First, this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. How well do you remember the Iranian hostage crisis in 1979? 35 years ago, at this time, we were in the first weeks of that Iranian hostage crisis. This hour, we have the pleasure of talking with native Iowan Catherine Kobe. Kobe is one of the 52 hostages that were held in Tehran for over a year. She joins us by phone this hour. Catherine, welcome.
Thank you.
And you're a resident of Waterloo now, I understand.
Yes, I made a move recently from Waverly.
All right, very good. Glad to have you on board. Wayne Moyer is with us as well, Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. Hello, Wayne.
Hi, Ben. Hi, Catherine.
Let's start off with you, Wayne Moyer, before we hear about Catherine's incredible experience. By the way, it's something she wrote about in a 1982 book, Guest of the Revolution. Wayne, set the scene before we hear Catherine's experience. Give us some context leading up to the day, November 4th, 1979, when the U.S. Embassy in Tehran was stormed and hostages were taken.
Well, I think we have to go back to 1953. And the prime minister, a guy by the name of Mohammad Mossadegh, at that time nationalized the Anglo-Iranian oil company and forced the Shah to leave the country. The U.S. staged a coup, brought the Shah back into power, and then strongly supported the Shah as a bastion against communist expansion to the south from the Soviet Union. And the U.S. gave him military aid. The U.S. trained his secret police, who were very repressive. And opposition develops. Then, at the end of December in 1977, President Carter made a very public toast to the Shah about how beloved he was to his people, which apparently catalyzed a lot of this opposition that had been building. The Shah is overthrown. Khomeini came back to Iran in February of 1979. The Shah fled the country. And then on October 22nd, 1979, President Carter admitted the Shah to the U.S. for medical treatment. The Shah was sick at that stage with cancer. And then just a few days later, the students took over the embassy. And I guess that's where Catherine takes it from there.
Right. And Catherine, you were not in the embassy when it was stormed. But before we get to your capture, I understand you came to work in Tehran just months before the hostage crisis began. You applied for a post. Why?
Okay. I'd like to say two things before we get to that. Many, many people forget that there was a long border with the Soviet Union in Iran. And in the 50s, when Mossadegh was taken out of power, the Red Menace was huge. It was just absolutely huge. And a lot of people forget that there was that long, long border that Iran shared with what was then the USSR. The other thing, you talk about the president's toast. One of the things that the kids told us while we were being held was that they were so offended by that because he used alcohol on a high holy day. Mm. Well, I doubt very much that Jimmy Carter used alcohol, but that was the perception. So those were two things that I would add to what
Wayne, the scene setting there, yeah.
Right, Right. Okay. I was a career Foreign Service officer, and I was serving in Zambia from 1975 to 1978. And, of course, that was a hotbed of political activity at that time, too, because there were wars of independence going on in Mozambique, Angola, Zimbabwe, and Namibia. My tour of duty, I was a career Foreign Service officer. My tour of duty was coming to an end, and I applied for several posts. I did not ask for Iran. Actually, I had asked for a post in the Soviet Union, and I was told I didn't need 44 weeks of language training, which is what Russian is. But I was asked then a couple of weeks later, and they had talked with me about going to Pakistan to serve in Lahore. But I got a phone call a couple of weeks later that said, we think you'd be perfect for this job in Iran, where you would go around the country with our American guests and visit the what we call binational centers. These were cultural centers that were operated mutually by Iran and the United States. And I said, well, what happened to I don't need 44 weeks of language training, because, of course, Farsi, Persian, was also a so-called hard language, and it took 44 weeks of basic training. They said, well, you know, the needs of the Foreign Service. And then, of course, the revolution happened. The Shah left, and the Ayatollah returned. And there was all of this discussion about the new Islamic Republic of Iran. When else do you get to be in on the ground floor of the development of a whole new country, of a whole new style of governance? It sounded like an exciting place to be.
So rather than repelling you, it appealed to you. It drew you to Tehran.
A lot of us, because if you're working in the whole geopolitical arena, this could have been absolutely fascinating, a most interesting time. And of course, I just come from the background of four very, very serious revolutions, not to mention what was going on in all of the work against apartheid in South Africa. So this seemed, and let's face it, basically the revolution in Iran was relatively bloodless. And we at this time were seeing all sorts of huge bloodshed going on in Guatemala, Nicaragua, lots of places. But they seem to have it under control. Also, one of the basic things that makes that would make change possible was so often in the countries in Africa and Central America, when a new person came to power, they faced almost unsurmountable odds in terms of no income, no infrastructure. Iran had everything. It had an amazing infrastructure because it had international trade. It had literally thousands of people who had been educated all over the world, in the United States, Germany, France, China, you name it, Japan. And they all wanted to come home and help with this new Islamic Republic. And, of course, the oil wells just kept pumping. There was money to build schools and roads, et cetera. It seemed like an absolutely incredible opportunity to look at what might happen in the development of a whole new way of life.
So, Catherine, when you showed up, I believe 4 months before the hostage taking occurred, what level of tension did you find?
Well, there were curfews. The Mujahideen were patrolling the streets. So we would go to work in the morning and basically go back to our homes in the evening before the curfew went into effect. But things were beginning to loosen up. People were sort of trying to see how far they could go, what could they do. For instance, I went to a concert at the university in which an Iranian pianist performed. There had been no concerts for several months. That was allowed. Soccer, football seemed to be going. Women weren't going very much to the soccer game, but occasionally. The university was open again. Classes were being held. So everyone was sort of edging toward a new status quo. But that alarmed some of the extremists, and so there had to be a reaction.
Mm-hmm. So November 4th, what do you remember about November 4th? That is the day that the embassy was stormed, hostages, the bulk of the hostages were taken. You were not there. You later became a hostage.
Right, the next day. Well, it was pretty amazing. We had spent the weekend. It was a long weekend. There was a holiday in there. And we had gone, driven up to the Caspian. It was just a day trip. We didn't stay overnight. But we had driven up to the north of Iran to the Caspian Sea and back. It was a Sunday morning because our weekends were Friday and Saturday, bowing to the Islamic tradition. I was in my office holding a staff meeting. I was the director of something called the Iran-America Society, which was one of these organizations throughout the country that was a binational center. And I was meeting with my staff in our regular meeting. We were discussing an exhibit that we were putting together, a film show that we were hoping we would be able to have, a local theater troupe was performing in our auditorium. I had met just a couple of weeks earlier with the directors of the German, the French, the Japan, and the Italian cultural centers, and we were all trying to figure out what we could and couldn't do in the new Islamic Republic. And so that's what my staff and I were doing when I got a phone call. Actually, my secretary interrupted the staff meeting and said, you know, I think you really should take this phone call. And it was one of my board members. I worked for a board that was half Iranian, half American. And he was concerned about what was going on at the embassy and wanted to know if there were any demonstrators outside the for shorthand, it was called the Anjuman. The full title was Anjuman Irano America, which means Iran America Cultural Center.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing was going on there. So some of my staff immediately went down to the embassy to see what they could figure out. And then my secretary said, oh, it's on the radio. And so we also turned on the TV to see what coverage we could have. And I called the embassy. The answer that I got from the embassy was embassy occupied. Well, I knew where the switchboard was located. It was in the basement of the embassy. And so I knew that we were in trouble. I had a direct line, which I had initially forgotten about because I hadn't used it that much, that I could use bypass the switchboard and call other offices in the embassy. And I called the front office and Ann Swift, who was one of the political officers, answered. She told me that Bruce Langen, who was the chargé d'affaires, the person in charge of the embassy, one of the security people, Mike Howland, and Vic Tomsith had gone to the foreign ministry that morning. They were trying to arrange a meeting with appropriate people in government, and they were at the foreign ministry, but that there was a mob of people outside, and that they were holding Al Golosinski, who was the other security officer at Knife Point. So she asked me to call the communication system, which was in a more secure part of the embassy, and I did. And they said, asked me to call State Department Ops Center, which I did. And so I was on two phones, one with Washington and one with the guys in the Ops Center. And later that morning, of course, not too long after I had talked with them, they had to destroy the communication equipment, and they were taken hostage.
And I understand you were in this office, not yet taken hostage, but in this time prior to becoming a hostage, you were relaying information back to the U.S. on the situation?
Right. Basically, my staff was sitting in front of the television and or the radio listening to what was going on, taking notes, and then they would translate those notes into English, and we'd try and give, you know, this was pre-satellite, I couldn't put out my iPhone and take pictures. So we were doing everything the old-fashioned longhand way, and, you know, literally the incredible Iranian staff that I had, just amazing, sat there and took notes from in Farsi and then read them back in English as to who, well, what people were saying, who seemed to be in charge, et cetera.
Yeah. And tell us the moment you were taken captive.
Well, it was the next day. I had gotten away once, and I had gone over to the Goethe Institute, which was just around the corner from our American Cultural Institute. And actually, the Germans had invited me to go to their homes and to not go back. But, you know, my colleagues were in trouble, and if I could help, and so hindsight said I should not have gone back, but I did. Mm. And so I was taken probably about 24 hours after most of the
incident. What was that moment of being taken captive like? Was it hostile?
Well, no. I mean, given what we have seen happen in Iraq, Afghanistan, and now with in Syria, our hostage situation was relatively benign. However, you don't know that when somebody points a gun at you and says, come with us. Mm-hmm. I was more concerned about one of about my assistant, my deputy, who is the director of the English program, Bill Royer, because, help, why hadn't I sent him away? Well, I should have. And one of our local Iranian secretaries, who they also bundled into the car, who was very, very upset. So okay. my concern was focused with them. And we were just piled into the back of a small car and driven to the embassy and then shut up in one of the homes. The embassy compound was fairly large, and there were some of the people who were on 24-hour call had residences there, and we were bundled into one of those.
Catherine Kobe is my guest, one of the 52 hostages held for over a year in the Iranian hostage crisis of 1979. Started in 79, went on to 1980. Wayne Moyer is with us as well. And Wayne, when we talk about, you have some personal memories of this too. You were on the in 1979, you were on the faculty at Grinnell, I believe.
Yes, I was.
And so you were a political science professor.
Yes. Take
us back to that time, because even those of us with that in our living memory, I certainly do. I was a teen. It was an amazing event that brought out the U.S. in a way that we hadn't seen it before. What was your reaction at the time as a political science professor as to the significance of this hostage taking?
Well, this seemed absolutely outrageous. I mean, the protection of diplomats is probably the most sacred thing about international law, and this had been broken. I think there were great concerns that this revolution would spread throughout the Middle East. I think nationally, there was an enormous burst of patriotism, a little bit like after 9/11, though maybe not quite so much. I think some of the fears we had of the revolution are somewhat similar to the fears we have of ISIS right now. There was, I think, the country came together that we had to do something about this. And of course, it gave the revolutionary government in Iran a very, very bad image, which to some extent it still holds today.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the initial reaction, one of the knee-jerk reactions would be to have a military strike here. Later, there was a rescue attempt under President Carter, the president at this time. Back to you, Catherine. So you are... you mentioned Anne Swift before. She became your roommate.
That's correct.
And how were you treated? I understand the first few weeks there was some intensive interrogation.
I can only talk about what happened to me because we were not held together. For me, because my job was in public diplomacy and what we do is so open, it was quite different because, I could say to them, look, anything I do is public record. You can write to Washington and ask them for our plans if you're not happy with what you found. It was quite different for me than it was for many of the people who were either in intelligence, whether it was military intelligence or whether they were political officers or whatever. Anne and I were separated on the 22nd of November, and we did not become roommates until the 12th of March. And it was, where have you been and what have you served? And they kept trying to turn me into a spy. And I kept telling them that wouldn't work because I was colorblind and I'd obviously pick up the wrong color briefcase.
their perception of the embassy was It was a den of spies.
Yeah, a nest of spies.
Nest of spies.
Was their term. Now, Mark Bowden spoke to a lot of, he spoke to as many of us as he could before he finished his book, Guests of the Ayatollah. And from what I've heard from conversation with some of the others, he has done a very accurate job of portraying what some of the others went through. So I would recommend that to anyone who wants to find out more about that. There was talk early on about mock trials and executions. And, you know, your mind is very wonderful in terms of what it can spin when you hear those sorts of things. There was a judge there at that time who was known as the hanging judge, and I believe his name was Hakali. And they talked about bringing him in to have trials and that sort of thing. Fortunately, that never happened.
Mm. Okay, so in your case, no torture, no threat of violence. How did they treat you, your guards?
That's right. Anne and I talked about that how were we going to characterize it? We had young women who were primarily university students who were our guards. They were as varied as taking any bunch of volunteers off of the Grinnell campus or the Wartburg campus or the UNI campus. And some of them were very precise and methodical, almost militaristic in their handling of us. Others were much more interested in talking about fashion and what their nieces and nephews were doing. One young woman I helped study for an English test, she was a pre-med student, and she was going to have an English test. And, if your language isn't strong enough and you're trying to describe urinary tract infection, you get into some amazing conversations. So Anne and I decided the word that we would use was correctly. They were our guards. We were their prisoners.
Mm, okay. So what did you do during the day to pass the time? This is over a year you're held hostage.
Okay. Having said that, I should say that the men have quite different stories about how they were treated. So people do need to remember that. Anne's and my experience was a little different than the men's. First of all, we stayed up late at night because there was almost always demonstration outside the embassy. And the quiet time that we would have would sort of happen between 10 or after 10, 10:30 at night when people would start to go home. And so we often stayed up until about 2 in the morning. So we often didn't get up until between 9 or 10 in the morning. We usually, Anne did morning exercises. They would bring us tea, some sort of bread, occasionally dates and cheese, very typical Iranian breakfast. I decided early on that I had been given a gift of time, and I was going to use it to see what I could discover about the contemplative lifestyle, which had always fascinated me, because I'm a talker and I love to talk, and I can't imagine anybody willingly being silent. But here was my opportunity. And so I spent my mornings trying to understand that in Bible study, prayer, pulling on the things that I had been taught as a child and as I was growing up.
Catherine, this is Wayne. I was wondering if you had any sense of how people in the States were reacting to your being taken hostage and to what was going on in terms of trying to negotiate your freedom.
That's a good question. We'll have to wait for the answer till after our break. Wayne Moyer is with us, Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. Catherine Cobe, one of 52 hostages held for over a year, 35 years ago, in the Iranian hostage crisis. We'll come back and talk more about her experience and get Wayne's observations about this pivotal time in geopolitics, I guess you'd have to say. Also, when we come back, we'll talk about the event of April of 1980, 8 U.S. servicemen killed when a helicopter and a transport plane collide during that failed attempt to rescue the hostages, Operation known as Desert One. We'll find out if Catherine got wind of that as a hostage when we come back and ask Wayne to describe how that rescue attempt went off. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. We're recalling the Iranian hostage crisis 35 years later, back in just a few minutes.
We are back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We're recalling the Iranian hostage crisis 35 years later, 1979 into 1980. We're talking with Iowa native Catherine Kobe, one of 52 hostages held for over a year. It's recounted in her 1982 book, Guest of the Revolution, Guests of the Revolution. And Wayne Moyer with us as well, Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. Before the break, Wayne, you asked a great question. Let's get Catherine's response to that. We all know, those of us with this in our living memory, of the turmoil, the concern here in the United States, around the world, for the hostages and this unprecedented action of taking hostages at a U.S. embassy. Catherine Kobe, what did you know about what was going on outside, in the outside world in the U.S., and efforts to free you?
It was very limited. We knew that the United States government was not going to pay ransom for our release. They were not going to give in to blackmail demands. They would negotiate and do whatever they could to affect our release. But that's just standard operating procedure for U.S. government, and it makes a great deal of sense. We had no idea, of course, what was going on in terms of Nightline. Later, at probably the second Christmas, I think Anne got a Christmas card that showed a yellow ribbon tied on a tree around the entrance to her cousin's home. So we knew, you know, that some people were remembering us. But knowing the way news functioned at that time, I thought we'd probably be front page story for maybe 3 or 4 days, and then, inside for another week or two, and then at 3 months, oh, by the way, we still have hostages somewhere. Mm. We had no idea of the full-out, flat-out, constant attention that we were getting.
In April of 1980, after several months, Wayne, of trying to negotiate for an end, there was an action taken by the U.S. military called Desert One. Wayne, would you describe what that was?
Well, essentially, President Carter had authorized, I think it was 7 or 8 helicopters that flew off. I think it was the Chester Nimitz, an aircraft carrier, to go and fly to Tehran and try to rescue the hostages. But the helicopters on the way had to put down to refuel. A couple of them got mechanical problems as they were refueling. They decided they lost one of the helicopters, or more than one, and they would not be able to successfully, or without too much risk, to go ahead. And Carter called back the mission. On the way back, as they were refueling, one of the helicopters hit the fueling plane, and I think 8 or 9 Americans were killed. And as a result, it was a colossal failure. And of course, the Iranians made the most of it.
Catherine, when did you find out about that?
We actually did not find out about it until July. We were given some back issues of Newsweek and a current issue. All of the stories had been about the U.S. Iranian situation had been torn out of the magazine, but the letters to the editor were still there, and so was the table of contents. And we learned a lot from that, including the fact at that point that 8 men had died trying to rescue us. And Anne and I were just absolutely wordless. We never did find a word to describe. It is so humbling to know that people will give their lives or go into a situation where there is a potential life-threatening thing to try and bring all of us home. It was they're the heroes of they are the heroes of this whole saga.
Catherine Kobe, I'm holding a copy of your 1982 book in my hand, Guest of the Revolution, and in it there's a photo of a letter that got through the censors, written to you by a young lady, I believe a 10-year-old, Jennifer Wilcox from Vermont. And this was a way you found out also about the rescue mission.
Right. I'm sorry the rescue attempt failed. I hope they try again, I think were the words
right.
that she used.
Right. Yeah, and I hope they try again. Dear Catherine, how are you? My name is Jennifer Wilcox. So this slipped through. You knew there had been that attempt. And as you said, a humbling experience to have.
The guard guard who was on duty that day had suffered at the Shah's hands. He was a truly remarkable person, and I'm not sure that it slipped through as much as it was allowed to slip through, because I think he knew that we needed to know.
So, Wayne, tell us about the circumstances, and we'll go to Catherine, too, about what finally brought the end of the hostage crisis.
Well, I think a good part of it was the Iran-Iraq war, which broke out while the hostages were still there, and the need to, I think, from the Iranian government's part, to negotiate some kind of solution to release the hostages. Also, I think they had gotten all that they could out of taking the hostages in terms of consolidating the revolution. But it was interesting that the negotiations apparently were extremely difficult, and we'd get close to an agreement, and then the Iranians couldn't agree among themselves, and then, I mean, enormously frustrating, I think, for President Carter. And then the fact that Carter couldn't bring it off while he was president, and they were released just after Ronald Reagan had taken the oath of office.
And this was really an intentional poke in the eye.
I think so.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the way you understand it, Catherine.
They hated Jimmy Carter the way people, and this is going back even further, the way people hated Richard Nixon. When I was in Washington at the time of Nixon's resignation, and you could almost feel the anger and the hatred directed toward President Nixon. And it was that same kind of just total anger and hatred directed to Jimmy Carter. And once Reagan was elected, there was no way. I said to Ann the day we found out that Reagan had been elected, I said, there's no way we'll be released before January 20th. And I said, that's Inauguration Day. And, of course, they didn't know what Reagan would do. So they very cleverly sort of released us almost, you know, in the no man's zone between the end of Jimmy Carter's administration and the beginning of Ronald Reagan's.
And Wayne, correct me if I'm wrong, but it is also viewed as one of the things that perhaps tipped the balance to not reelect Jimmy Carter to a second term, the failure of Desert One, and also this shadow of the hostage crisis.
What was it, 12-13%? Inflation.
Yes. Inflation, the horrible state of the economy. Wayne?
I think this was a key factor in the collapse of Jimmy Carter, and might well have made the difference between his reelection. But the fact that the hostage situation had so preoccupied him and he was unable to do anything about it and the rescue mission had failed, I think, was a major factor in his falling popularity.
Catherine, we're running out of time, about 10 minutes left in our conversation. Tell us about the day you learned of your release, because I'm sure over the course of over a year, there were times when you hoped that the release was a matter of days or hours, but it probably turned out not to be the case. When did you know it was the real deal?
The morning that we were released, basically, sometime at mid-morning, they came in and said, you're going home, get your stuff ready. They had never said, you're going home before. They'd said, we're moving you or whatever. But until we were actually on the plane, the Algerian Airlines plane, ready to head out, I don't think any of us believed that it was really going to happen. And there was a wild cheer that went up when the captain announced, we're out of Iranian airspace. So that was
a cheer, and I imagine some tears.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. So, well, we were just so excited, number one, that we were going home and that all of us were there, and that no one, at least on the surface, appeared to be terribly injured.
To go back to something that our listeners will also be aware of, you had contact with the hostages who actually escaped, who were portrayed in the recent film Argo.
Oh, yes. we all knew each other. We'd been in language school together. And four of them, Mark and Cora and Joe and Kathy, had come to my offices and stayed on the phones that first night so I could get some sleep. I slept on one of the couches in the library, and they manned the phones for about 6 hours. And then they left to go back to one of their places before they were taken in by the Canadians.
Mm-hmm. You were aware that they were being sought and that it was a hazard to have them around.
Well, everybody. Yeah, I was just delighted that they were free, and I hope that they would find a way out. So,
you mentioned earlier how vastly you underestimated the reaction of the attention you were given by U.S. media, U.S. citizens. Tell me about the day you set foot on U.S. soil again.
Well, we had been in Wiesbaden, and of course, what we wanted to see was the hockey game, because we had heard that the at the end of our takeover, the Iranians had the Russians had invaded Afghanistan, and for once there was a bigger boogeyman than we were for a short time, and so they did let us know that we had beat the Russians at hockey, and so that was what people wanted to see, and so they saw that in Wiesbaden, and then we flew back and we landed outside in Newburgh, in New York, outside of not far from West Point, where we were greeted by family members and then bused to the Thayer Hotel on the West Point campus, where we were able to sort of decompress with our families for 2 or 3 days without any outside intervention.
What do you remember about the celebration? A huge parade. You met President Carter, President-elect Reagan.
Well, President Carter came to Wiesbaden, and I had a chance to speak to him there. President and Mrs. Reagan met us in the Oval Office at the White House and greeted us there before we were presented, I guess, after the parade from Andrews Air Force Base to the White House, where we were just officially welcomed home by the president. And then later we were in New York for a ticker tape parade, which was a lot of fun because I'd lived in New York at one time, had friends there, and a sister who lived there, so that was great.
And eventually got back to your native Iowa, where you were welcomed also Robert Ray.
Robert Ray was the governor, and he welcomed me. Terry Branstad told me he hoped I never ran against him because he never heard me give the same speech twice.
Let's talk about the way this has a wing. Can I ask you, broadly speaking, how has the Iranian hostage crisis, the Iranian revolution, which took place before that, shaped the politics, the relations between the United States and Iran ever since?
Well, of course, it created an incredible amount of distrust and hostile feelings, I think, in the United States, which we still see signs of. Then and things got worse because when I think the hostage situation was one of the factors that triggered Saddam Hussein to invade Iran. Then the U.S. helped Saddam Hussein, and then the war created so much debt for Iraq that it invaded Kuwait, which then we responded with the 1991 Persian Gulf War, and then you could tie that to the more recent Iraq War. But we've always been afraid, I think, since the hostage situation that the Iranian government would be trying to expand its influence in the Middle East, and whatever it did would be hostile to the interests of the United States. And then the recent fears of building a nuclear weapon, I think there's still a legacy of, I think, the hostage situation, maybe on both sides, but certainly on the side of the United States, that there are a lot of people who do not want who will never trust the Iranians to keep any kind of agreement.
Catherine, what are your takeaways from this up to the present day? looking back?
Well, I think the one of the biggest pieces of fallout was that it disrupted the diplomatic relations between the two countries. You know, you said they broke every diplomatic rule, but the irony of it is I believe that ancient Persia was very much instrumental in setting up the immunity for diplomats. So I guess if anybody had a right to withdraw the rules, it might have been them. And when there is no diplomacy, there's no conversation. And yes, there is distrust on both sides, but there are so many things that we share in terms of the appreciation for good food, good music, literature, traditions, education, medicine. There are so many areas in which we could work in common and in which we could help. And Iran is a country that should have its place at the table. You know, I keep thinking about how many years we tried to ignore mainland China, and that didn't really work either.
The story stretching right up to very recent news that I'll mention as we end the hour. On Monday, the U.S. agreed to extend the nuclear negotiations with Iran for another 7 months. This was met with protests from Republicans and some Democrats in our Congress, as well as from hardliners in Iran's parliament. But also, I'm reading in the New York Times, it also raised alarms among former hostages like you, Catherine. As part of this extension, Iran will continue to receive $700 million a month in funds that were frozen under Western sanctions way back then, money that the surviving hostages and their families believe should be used as a financial settlement for captivity. How do you feel about Iran receiving this money?
Well, part of our release was, I think, precipitated by the fact that they needed money to fight the war with Iraq. And so it is their money. I think, you know, it's hard to say. Every one of us came home with a different story. I support my colleagues, and I am part of that class action suit, and it would be wonderful to receive compensation for it. But I keep thinking of one of my colleagues who keeps saying, I love that country. I loved working there. I loved being there. I just wish that somebody could officially say they didn't do it right. There was a better way to do it.
Mm. It's been 35 years since you were a hostage, Catherine Kobe. You must have been interviewed, I can't think how many times, about this topic. You must admit to getting tired, I imagine, of having this be such a big part of your identity.
Well, I met a Miss America shortly after I came home, and she had been a Miss America 15 years earlier, and I wanted to ask her every hokey question she had ever been asked about walking down that aisle when Burt Reynolds sang, there she is, here she is, Miss America. And I realized this is the box in which a lot of people are going to see me, and so I try and deal with it and ignore it when I can. And when it's important, and I think it is important for children to know that history didn't happen in a vacuum. It affected real people. And so I do History Day stuff with students. And as long as it serves some real purpose, it's okay.
What do you find to be the greatest misconceptions that we have about the Iranians and that period of history?
Oh, that they're all evil. Just like they, you know, wanted to paint the Americans with a broad brushstroke of the great Satan. And how many Iranians said, but you're different? Or how many times have I heard that internationally, not just Iranians? You're different. You're a real American. And I think our willingness to use stereotypes to identify people, and it's not just Iranians. We do it with communities. We do it in our own country. I think of what's going on in Ferguson, and part of that is stereotypes. We need to remember every single person is an individual with their own individual habits, their own individual being, and their own individual tastes.
Closing thoughts from you, Wayne Moyer, as we reflect on this hour and that event?
I think it's really important that Catherine is still speaking about this. I think it's remarkable that having gone through the set of experiences that she went through, that she is still able to see Iranians as the wide spectrum of people that they are, with different interests and different concerns, that there's some shared interests with the United States, the importance of establishing relations again with them. I think it, in light of the hostility that I think is still engendered, I think this is critically important for all of us.
Mm-hmm. What do you see, Wayne, in the future of U.S.-Iranian relations?
Well, I'm hoping that we will get this nuclear agreement through. There are clearly a lot of people who want it to get through, and that then gradually that our relations will improve. I hope that will be the case.
Catherine Kolb, do you envision a time when the U.S. and Iran are in such a way in terms of relations that you could, if you wanted to, return to Iran?
I would like to believe that's possible. There's some neat people there I'd like to see again.
Who would you like to see?
Some of the people that worked for me. And one of the women who was one of our guards, she was a teacher. She was very concerned about education, particularly for girls. She was concerned about the rural areas. We had a lot in common, and it would be nice to talk to her and say, you know, did it happen? Were you able to help some of it happen?
Mm-hmm. So we've come to the end of this hour. What a fascinating time. And Catherine, we're so glad that you have chosen to talk about this once again. It's captivating, if I can use that word, and probably incorrectly in this context. Fascinating to hear you recount that time. And I'm glad Wayne Moyer could lend his expertise to this hour. Thank you so much, Wayne.
Thanks. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, Wayne. It's been a pleasure.
Catherine Kolb, one of 52 hostages held for over a year in 1979, 1980. She recounts it in a 1982 book, Guest of the Revolution. Wayne Moyer, Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. Friday on this program, after some Thanksgiving special programming, my interview with Al Jarreau. He attended the University of Iowa in the mid-60s before becoming a jazz legend. That's Friday on this program. River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Lindsay Moon, and Emily Woodbury. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.